Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is The Exchange. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York has an unusual descriptor among candidates running for president. She has never lost an election. First elected to the House in 2006, she was appointed to the Senate 3 years later and has since been reelected twice. A graduate of Dartmouth College and the UCLA School of Law, Gillibrand has served as a law clerk and later as a lawyer in the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development under the Clinton administration. And now she is seeking the nation's highest office. Today on the program, a conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Kirsten Gillibrand. And your questions are welcome. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And you can also comment on our Facebook page, where we are streaming a live video of this conversation. Just go to Facebook and search for NHPR Exchange. Senator Gillibrand, thanks for being on the program.
Oh, I'm delighted to be on your show.
Looking forward to getting to know you. Our listeners certainly want to get to know you ahead of the First in the Nation primary. So to that end, one of our listeners asked, if asked to choose just one thing, what would you want the American public to know about you and your candidacy?
That I will fight for every single one of them, no matter who they are, where they live, or who they love, and that I am someone who goes to all the places in a country, whether it's red places, blue places, or purple places, listens, absorbs, empathizes, and then takes on those fights as my own. I've never backed down from a fight. I take on the fights that other people won't, and I actually win. And that's been my story. I've taken on the Pentagon twice, first over Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, and then over sexual violence in the military. I've taken on Congress many times, first as a member of Congress, posting my earmarks and my schedule and my financial disclosures and taxes online, first person ever to do it, and then actually passing a bill to ban insider trading by members of Congress. And even as a member of Congress from New York, I took on the banks. When we had the financial collapse and both parties were throwing billions at the banks, I bothered to read the bill, and I realized it was designed to leave taxpayers holding the bag. So I don't back down, and I will fight anyone if it's right. I will go through fire to do what's right, and I think this country deserves a president who's brave, and that's who I am.
You have turned the fight towards President Trump in many instances, and one of the signature themes of your campaign is that you're an advocate for women, and President Trump, as you say, is starting a war on women. What do you mean by that when you say President Trump is waging a war on women?
He has spent his presidency dismissing women, demeaning women, and devaluing women in every sense. Not only as a candidate did he have more than a dozen sexual assault allegations against him, but he has used his platform, his bully pulpit, to demean women, particularly women of color. How he's used his Twitter feed, how he's constantly been name-calling. And the all-out assault by President Trump and the Republican Party, as well as 30 legislatures around the country on women's reproductive freedom, just shows how little he values women. He is trying to take away women's reproductive freedom, the ability for women to make the most important decisions of their lives, these very complex and difficult healthcare decisions, and taking away their agency, taking away their bodily autonomy. And he has made every effort to appoint judges and justices and embolden these legislatures around the country to upend women's reproductive rights by overturning Roe v. Wade. They fully intend to overturn Roe v. Wade, which is the constitutional protection, a right to privacy for women to make these fundamental human rights decisions, civil rights decisions about their own bodies. And if President Trump wants a war on women, and it's a Trump, it is a war that he will have, it's one he's actually going to lose.
So we're going to come back to a number of the issues that you just brought up, health care, abortion rights, appointment of judges and so on. But I did want to get you to respond, first of all, to one of the big news stories of the day. And that's that President Trump said in an interview a few days ago that he'd be willing to receive opposition research from a foreign country about a political opponent. He made no bones about that in a conversation with George Stephanopoulos, after which you reiterated your call for impeachment proceedings. You said they had to start now. But what made you want to start impeachment proceedings in the first place?
So from the beginning, I've believed that we need to have transparency and accountability, and we needed a process. I thought it was very important that we got access to the Mueller report in an unredacted form, which we have yet to get. I wanted to hear testimony from Mueller himself, from McGahn, and from Attorney General Barr. Because President Trump has obstructed that process, the process of letting Congress elucidate facts, ask for testimony, see unredacted, an unredacted copy of the Mueller report, and the fact that Mueller came out and really emphasized that this was not just Russia tinkering at the margins, that this was an all-out attempt to undermine and subvert our election. And the fact that he emphasized that he's done his job and now it's Congress's job, that he did not have the authority to indict a sitting president. And in fact, if he could have exonerated the president, he would have. I think he's really just emphasized the fact that it's time for Congress to do its job. So I have said since said that we need to start the proceedings, the actual hearings that align with an impeachment proceeding, because we need the facts. And if we can have greater authority to get those facts through an impeachment proceeding, we need to start it. And now that he's added the statement that he believes it's appropriate to allow a foreign country to somehow undermine our elections it's shocking. And it's something that is unprecedented and just shows how far afield this president is from basic ethics.
Mm-hmm. Not all Democrats are on board with starting impeachment proceedings yet. What do you make of the debate within your party about whether or not to start impeachment proceedings?
Well, my perspective is we are entitled to the facts. We are entitled to transparency and accountability. And no one is above the law, including President Trump. So I think we need the information. And I trust that Speaker Pelosi will continue to elevate the issue and to try to get these hearings completed and get the facts. She clearly wants a process, too. So I will continue to advocate for that level of transparency.
Intelligence agencies have said that it's clear Russia and China as well may be preparing to influence the next election. What would you do as a senator, because you're currently a senator, what could you do as a senator to sort of protect the integrity of the election process?
So I've been working on this since President Trump got elected. I sit on the Armed Services Committee. I've been on that committee for 10 years. And as a member of that committee, I am trying to make sure that the Department of Defense has all the authorities they need to treat these intrusions as the actual attack on our democracy, an attack on our country that it is. And so we've been giving them not only authority, but resources to shore up our electoral system, to make sure that our cyber experts, our cyber warriors in the DOD are fully engaged in protecting our infrastructure, as critical infrastructure as they should be. And so we've also tried to pass legislation that would fund each state so that they would have resources to have a paper receipt for every vote cast. So if there is election interfering again, we can do a viable recount of every vote in America. President Trump has blocked that legislation, that bipartisan legislation. And so I think that we keep shining a light on the issue to try to move that legislation forward. In the interim, a lot of our philanthropies and not-for-profits around the country are trying to make up for the deficit in government leadership on this. And it's one of the things I just disagree so severely with President Trump. He's afraid to protect our country. He is a failure in leadership when it comes to standing up to Putin and Russia and standing up to other world leaders when they're trying to undermine our democracy and our country.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we're speaking with New York Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Kirsten Gillibrand. Call now with your questions. We're going to be talking about health care shortly. 1-800-892-6477. You can also send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I wanted to return to the subject of abortion for a moment. You've taken a strong pro-choice position, and you've said you'd only appoint judges that support Roe v. Wade. Is this kind of contingent support of a position an inappropriate litmus test for judges?
No. I think the issue of women's reproductive freedom is a basic civil right. It's a basic human right. And I don't think it's something that should be ideological or political because it is settled precedent. It's been settled precedent for over 40 years and been law of the land to guarantee women this basic constitutional right. So I believe that from my perspective, I will only appoint judges and justices that believe in Roe v. Wade as settled precedent. But I also believe that President Trump and Senator McConnell have already changed the rules. President Trump has so politicized this issue, providing as a candidate a list of 20 judges he'd consider appointing, all of whom are anti-choice people who are committed to overturning Roe. And I think that is contrary to established precedent of how we choose justices. He's already said his goal is to overturn Roe, and he's really broken the mold of appointing judges and justices that follow the law and will uphold settled precedent. Both Kavanaugh and Gorsuch said they would uphold settled precedent, and I think both of them were misleading to Congress.
Mm-hmm. One of our Facebook listeners on Facebook asked about your comparison between abortion and racism. You've seemed to suggest recently that appointing a judge who opposes abortion rights is akin to supporting judicial nominees who hold racist views, suggesting there's no moral other side to the abortion debate. Is that what you believe?
So the point I was making is that we believe in settled precedent in this country, and we have settled precedent to make sure we value everyone and we don't discriminate based on race, gender, and religious backgrounds. If you were a judge who wants to be a justice and you believed that you should upend or reverse 40 years of precedent on seeing racism as against the Constitution, if you don't support recent precedent that LGBT equality is important, that marriage equality is a human right, if you look at Roe v. Wade and say, I don't believe that women have a constitutional right to privacy, you are upending settled precedent. And more than that, you're upending the social compact we have as a country, that we have long past decided as a country that we don't believe in sexism, racism, homophobia over the last several decades. And I just believe that this is settled precedent. It is law of the land. And if you as a presidential candidate believe that you should upend law of the land that's been there for 40 years, it is so disruptive to the American culture and our views of the world that it's going backwards in a way that I just don't think is legitimate. Mm-hmm. So it's an issue of what kind of judges and justices do you appoint? And to me, as someone at the forefront of women's rights and the question of do we value women, imagine a judge who said, you know, I really don't believe in equal pay for equal work. I really believe that that we shouldn't have gender equity or gender equality. I don't believe that LGBTQ Americans have a right to be treated equally. I don't believe that Muslims have a right to be treated equally. Those are so contrary to how we think about the world that I just am not going to appoint a judge or justice who doesn't believe women deserve equality.
Fair enough. But there's a question of equality. There's a question of morality. And then there's a question of law. I mean, the reason we have some things like civil disobedience because the law doesn't always line up with morality. So the question I think the listener was going for was that, is it fair to say someone who does not believe in abortion under any circumstances is as equally morally reprehensible as someone who holds racist views?
My statement had nothing to do with your personal views. nothing to
do with
person
law?
Abuse.
Is that what you're saying?
It has to do with settled precedent. And the question and my answer was specific to what kind of judges I would appoint. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's legitimate to appoint a judge who doesn't believe in women's equality. I don't, because it's settled precedent. You can have whatever religious view, which is the whole point of our constitutional democracy. We believe in the separation of church and state. We believe in freedom of religion. We believe in freedom of speech. And so you have those freedoms to have your perspective on how you see the world, whether it's women's rights or gay rights issues of race and all of that. You are entitled to your views and your beliefs. But when we talk about settled precedent and we talk about law of the land, if your goal is to upend 40 years of precedent, that women have relied on a right to privacy for 40 years, and you all of a sudden say, I don't really believe in that, you are changing the social contract that we have with women in America. You're changing it. You're saying, you, women of America, you don't deserve bodily autonomy. We can force you to take that pregnancy to term, even if it was conceived from rape or incest, even if you will die in childbirth. We have the highest maternal mortality rate in the industrialized world. I mean, it's shocking. So you're telling America's women, you don't have human rights. You don't have civil rights. You don't have bodily autonomy, and you don't have agency over the most important decision you will make. One out of four women in America access abortion services. Most of the women who do are already mothers. So you're making a decision about, can I survive this pregnancy? Is this a pregnancy that is possible for me to take to term? These are personal decisions. They're healthcare decisions. They're economic decisions. They're moral decisions. And a woman has a right to make all those decisions. And if you are telling me today that women in America don't have that right, I think you're so backward looking that those judges and justices are not the type of people we should be appointing, because it's too backward looking.
For the sake of timing, that we have so much to talk about, I think we understand your point there. I want to turn to healthcare, because that's such a weighty topic that listeners really care about. And just a note for listeners, as we covered the First in the Nation primary, we want to hear from all of you listening or watching on Facebook Live. How should we cover the presidential primary? What kind of coverage would you like to see from us? You can find the survey at nhpr.org and clicking on NH Primary 2020. You can also find that link pinned to the top of our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. So, Senator Gillibrand, you've supported Medicare for All in your first campaign in 2006. You're still supporting that. I wanted to ask you about something that came up recently in the news. The American Medical Association, the nation's largest group of representing doctors, just said no to single-payer and yes to improving and strengthening Obamacare. So tell us, why is Medicare for All and single-payer the sort of the right way, and why are these doctors wrong?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that you can get to health care as a right and not a privilege on top of a for-profit insurance industry. I don't think you'll get there. I just don't see it, because the for-profit insurance industry has a goal of quarterly profits. They have a goal of shareholder value, and they happen to pay their CEOs millions of dollars. So all that, I say, is fat in the system that's just not going to care. And I don't believe the for-profit insurance industry actually adds value to our healthcare system at all. In fact, experience of voters across this country is it's your insurer who says you can't spend that second day in the hospital. It's your insurer who says you can't have that medicine that you need. It's your insurer who says you can't have that procedure. Not your doctor. Not what's best for your health. It's what's best for their profits. Routinely, insurance companies are putting profits over people, and that to me is the definition of greed. So I want to displace that market through competition of a not-for-profit public option. I believe you let any American buy into Medicare at a price that they can afford, you will see a mass divergence away from private for-profit insurance companies into this public option. I believe if you create a transition period of 4 or 5 years, most Americans will move in because it's cheaper. If you can buy in at, you know, some percentage of income, let's say 4 or 5%, it's affordable. It's more affordable. And if your employer matches it, it's sustainable. If you stop looking at healthcare as a commodity that you have to afford to be able to pay for and a right, then the only way to do it is a not-for-profit public option. And I believe that Americans will choose it. And if they do, you can make it an earned benefit. just like Social Security. It will be sustainable, it will be permanent, and it will be universal. And people who have Medicare love it. They think it covers the things they need, it's accessible, and it's affordable.
So just like Social Security, there's a line in your paycheck for that. Will there also be a line in your paycheck for this?
That is my vision. And I would love to have a line in your paycheck where you just buy in your whole life, no matter if you're working full-time or part-time, big companies, small companies, that your employer will always match, and that's your earned benefit. Just like Social Security, it should be a social safety net. It should be social insurance, because if it's a right and not a privilege, that's how you build it.
So would healthcare be contingent upon having a job like it is now, just in a different way?
Well, no, because we have Medicaid. And so if you are unemployed or you are unable to work, you will still get access through Medicaid. But it's one of the other parts of my vision for the country is really investing in job training so that anybody who's unemployed or underemployed has access to pipeline training right into jobs in their community in the fields they want. And we have great examples of that in New Hampshire.
Under that system, what would happen to the Veterans Health Administration?
The VA would still exist and you'd continue to grow. Eventually, you'll have a very vibrant social insurance network of providers and they'll all be linked. So you'll have economies of scale. You'll be able to bend the cost curve. Two things I would change to build this. Number one, make your reimbursement rates for Medicare the reflection of cost. It has to be the cost of the procedure, not a discounted rate. Because if you ask any hospital or provider or doctor in America, your only patients are going to be Medicare or Medicaid patients. They would tell you they will go out of business. So make sure you have transparency in pricing and that the reimbursement rate's real. Second, take on the drug companies. Again, any problem we have in America, I can show you the greed and corruption standing in the way. When we passed Medicare Part D under George W. Bush, Congress, again, beholden to the special interests and the lobbyists, they wrote in a protection for the drug manufacturers that Medicare couldn't buy in bulk and get the lowest price. That's going to change on day one. You're going to get the lowest price, but you have to be able to take on the system. You got to take on the insurance and you got to take on the drug companies if you hope to ever solve this problem.
I wanted to ask you about the opioid crisis. We were prompted by one of our listeners who's framed this in a way that connects with how the pharmaceutical industry conducts business, referring to it as big pharma. So what in your view is the relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the opioid crisis, and what could you do as president to sort of reverse the problem?
Well, I think they're part of the problem. If you look at the documents we found about the Sackler family and how they desired to make opioids more addictive and desired to sell more drugs to more people so they could make money, they put their profits over the people they were supposed to be helping. And so I have legislation on price gouging to stop price gouging in pharmaceuticals across the board and to actually pull back profits if they continue to engage in it. But two, I believe in criminal investigations into the opioid crisis and into whether these drug producers, as well as certain pharmaceutical companies, as well as certain pharmacies participated and certain doctors participated in sending too many drugs out into communities with no regard for who would get addicted and what would happen to them. So I think we need full transparency and accountability. And then in New Hampshire and in other states, we need more resources to do more prevention and to have more treatment centers and more treatment beds available in every community for those who are addicted.
Question from a listener. New Hampshire is the second oldest state in the country per capita. And we have a growing issue regarding people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. What will you do to support these individuals, families, and caregivers?
So I have two ideas. Right now, home health aides are underpaid. I don't think some of them even get the minimum wage. And so we need to make sure that we create a pipeline of young people who want to go into healthcare. It's one of the reasons why I'm running on national public service to get to debt-free college. If you offer every young person who's willing to do a year of public service, 2 years of community college or state school free, 2 years of community service, 4 years free, what you will do is create a pipeline into public service careers such as healthcare, education, green jobs, first responders, and of course, military. It's an expansion of the GI Bill. So if you make one of these career opportunities healthcare, you're going to basically give young kids an opportunity to begin to get training as home health aides, as healthcare workers, so that they can maybe envision this as a career for themselves. Because if you're going to have the baby boomers age, we're going to have an explosion of Alzheimer's patients that need 24/7 care. And for a lot of our seniors, they would rather age age in place. They would rather be in their homes. And so you're going to need far more home health workers. So I would raise their pay, make sure they get at least $15 an hour, and I would index the minimum wage to inflation and make sure we have no more tipped wage. So you start at 15 and grow. And I would incentivize young people to go into this industry through our national public service bill.
We'll talk more about some of those ideas after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're talking today with New York Senator and Democratic candidate for President Kirsten Gillibrand. And when we come back, we'll talk about the economy, we'll talk about climate change, we'll talk about rural America. But you can call now with your questions. Call now so we can get you into the discussion when it starts. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
I believe global climate change is the greatest threat to humanity that exists today. And if you have a threat that is that big, you need a solution that is equally as big and visionary. So I have a couple of ideas about how to address global climate change. First, I would pass a Green New Deal. And I believe we should get to net zero carbon emissions in the next 10 years. And that's hard. It's not an easy goal. And that goal frightens some people. But the ideas behind the Green New Deal are all bipartisan. Investing in our infrastructure, high-speed rail, rural broadband, a new electric grid, more mass transit, roads, bridges, sewers. Second part is clean air and clean water. There's nothing more bipartisan than that. Here in New Hampshire, you've got bipartisan efforts to get rid of PFOA and PFAS in our military bases, as well as legacy manufacturing pollution. So guarantee it and invest in it, which is bipartisan. And third, making sure that we invest in green jobs. I talked about my national public service idea, asking young people to go into STEM fields so they can be part of the innovators and inventors in all of the new energy sources, whether it's wind, solar, geothermal, hydropower, or biofuels. So really incentivize the world to get invested in new technologies and new breakthrough ideas. Second, beyond those three things, I would also put a price on carbon. I think it's really important to begin to reward innovators, those who are focused on energy efficiency and new technologies, and make sure you tax at a higher rate polluters because they are not part of the solution, they are part of the problem. But more than that, we need leadership on the world stage. President Trump walked away from global climate accords. I would lead the global climate accords. I would not only rejoin Paris, but I would create an international, worldwide competition on which country is the strongest and boldest when it comes to tackling global climate change. How about instead of a space race with Russia, how about a green energy race with China? How about make a call to action to America's youth? You are going to be the inventors and solution finders of our future. You're going to be the ones that are going to break through. Just like when John F. Kennedy said, I want to put a man on the moon in 10 years, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. Same thing. I want to get to net zero carbon emissions in the next 10 years, not because it's easy, because it's hard.
Well, how do you incentivize a country like China to actually reduce the amount
compete.
Of green...
Compete. There's so much interest in the world in competition. It's our human nature. And so I would really egg on the world community to see if you can outperform the U.S. I bet you can't. Unfortunately...
So it's a matter of pride, a matter of national pride, you think,
national
will motivate
pride,
them?
National security, national effectiveness. And that's what John F. Kennedy did. If you remember that speech, he said it was a measure of whether we could win. It was a measure of our inventiveness and effectiveness and competitiveness. It should be the same. And that's what a world leader can do. That's the benefit of the bully pulpit. You can actually inspire your own country so every engineer, every scientist, every mathematician wants to solve the problem. You can also inspire a generation, which I will do.
So you mentioned a tax on polluters. Is that the only way you have to pay for a Green New Deal plan, or is there something else that would help finance, say, the massive infrastructure improvements that you just mentioned?
I have a lot of ideas about how to pay for my big ideas. One simple one is a transaction tax, actually taking a few pennies on every $100 of stocks and bonds that are traded. If anything, it creates enormous amounts of revenue, and it disrupts really only one industry, which is flash trading, which I don't believe actually creates value. And I think what it's done is distorted our stock market, distorted value, because it's based on how close your server is to the actual exchange. It's milliseconds that creates your wealth. And so I believe that we should have a transaction tax. It creates $77 billion a year and $770 billion over 10, which is a lot of resources you can invest in national public service, job training, and particularly all these ideas under the Green New Deal.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the economy. And listeners, again, weigh in if you'd like. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You've described China as an economic threat and said that you take on China in a very different way than has President Trump. How would you describe that way?
So you do need to hold China accountable when they cheat. And they do. They are a country that typically violates our international trade norms. They dump steel on the market. They manipulate their currency. They steal IP. And so for a lot of our companies in America, they think China's a very difficult competitor because they don't often play by the same rules. So you need to hold them accountable, but you can do that far more effectively by using multilateralism, by engaging our allies in sanctions and other responses when China cheats. But I don't think the trade war that President Trump has created is effective.
So sanctions, but not necessarily tariffs.
And also, you can use tariffs, but you need to use them strategically at the appropriate time. But a trade war is terrible. We have already seen President Trump's goal was to change the trade deficit. Our trade deficit with China has actually grown under his administration. It's to make sure we have markets. Like, we want to have markets for our producers and our exporters. Well, when you have a trade war with China, the price of steel goes right up. So for New Hampshire's manufacturers, the things they make are going to cost a lot more to make, and they're not going to be able to sell it at a price people can afford. And so they will make less money, if not go out of business. And that's the reality we're in. It's true also for our farmers and our producers.
President Trump has made much of trying to bring companies that have moved out of the United States back home. Is that something you're interested in trying to do? And if so, how would you do it?
Absolutely. I have a very broad-based legislation on how we're going to start rewarding work in this country again with real carrots and sticks. We haven't rewarded work in a long time. It's why I think we lost a lot of voters in the last election.
I'm not sure what you mean by work, as I'm referring to bringing companies back.
So two things. One, I have a bill called End Outsourcing Act, which will punish companies that choose to outsource as opposed to reinvest in this country. Right now, the tax code allows them to have massive tax deductions, even for moving jobs overseas. I would eliminate that, and I would make sure they're punished for sending jobs overseas. But I would also strengthen unions here at home, because when you strengthen unions, it allows workers to have a voice, allows them to get higher pay and better benefits. When workers have a seat at the table, companies actually do better. They thrive. I like employee ownership. I have incentivized, even in the last Congress, I passed legislation that helped small business owners who want to retire, sell those businesses to their employees. I've seen shuttered companies across this country and in New York that if they had just, instead of selling their company to China or some other country or some other multinational, they could have sold those industries to their employees, and those companies would still be in this country and they'd still be thriving. But they chose an easy way out because the tax code rewards them. So I would stop rewarding outsourcing. I would start incentivizing keeping jobs here, and I would start rewarding work again, looking at our employees as our source of innovation and wealth and the importance of our company, as opposed to just our shareholders. Right now, every business school in America teaches you shareholder supremacy. First dollar goes to a shareholder, not a worker. I would try to change that and make sure companies understand that they also could invest in their employees and could invest in the middle class, and maybe even consider common good companies and a lower tax rate if you plan on having a social social mission, a social mission-driven company that cares about the common good, whether it's workers in the middle class, family-friendly policies, or green energy and energy efficiency, giving real parameters for socially conscious companies, because I think that will, again, start rewarding work, which we have not been doing in a long time.
We have this comment from Andrew from Keene on Facebook. He says, if Senator Gillibrand becomes president, what would she do to eliminate sub-minimum wages for workers with disabilities? In New Hampshire, we don't have to worry about sheltered workshops or paying a person with a disability less than the federal minimum wage, but in other states, it's perfectly legal to pay someone literally pennies on the dollar. S-260, the Transition to Competitive Employment Act, would help sunset this awful provision. So your thoughts on Andrew's comments, Senator Gillibrand?
Well, I agree with Andrew that we shouldn't pay anyone less than the minimum wage. And I believe that the minimum wage should be a living wage. I support $15 an hour, and I support indexing it to inflation and getting rid of the tip minimum wage. I also support investing in job training to deal with underemployment. We have so much underemployment in New Hampshire and other states around this country, and people who want to be working more hours or for a higher wage and actually have more skills that just need to be developed. So I would invest, I would have the federal government invest in our community colleges, our state schools, our apprenticeship programs, and our not-for-profits that will provide pipeline training right into jobs in the community, in the field. And that's something that our disabled community could access and really thrive from, because we just want everyone working at their fullest potential. And a lot of times that just meets opportunity, and it needs more directed job training.
I want to ask you about your position on guns. You've changed your position on guns in the NRA when you represented a conservative district in New York, relatively conservative in the House. You received a favorable rating from the NRA. That changed when you became a senator, and now you support gun control measures. This has been covered extensively, but I did want to ask you specifically, was there something that changed your mind? Was there an encounter with a person, or you learned a fact, something that made you rethink your position and come to a new conclusion on guns?
Yes. 10 years ago, when I became senator of New York, I very quickly started to visit all parts of my state and listen to communities and families that were suffering from gun violence, from gang violence. And I met a family, parents who lost their daughter, Nyasia Pryor Yard, and I met her whole high school class. And when you meet someone who has lost a loved one to gun violence and you listen to their story, it is so convicting. Immediately, you know, you need to lead on that issue. Immediately, you need to know to make sure that person didn't die in vain. And so not only did I agree to lead, and I started working on legislation to end gun trafficking. One of the biggest problems in New York is that guns used in gun crime are typically trafficked from out of state, from other jurisdictions that don't have good gun control laws, right into the hands of criminals. And so not only do I support a federal anti-trafficking law, but I support universal background checks, as well as banning large magazines and military-style assault weapons, because we need to stop the horrible gun crime in this country and gun violence. I would also make significant investments in mental health and trying to have intervention programs for young people in grade school, high school, college, who are right now falling through the cracks and tend to be often our shooters that end in massive gun death.
The shooting in Virginia Beach just a few weeks ago took place with a pistol, not with an automatic assault rifle that we've seen in schools, for example. Is there a law that could be passed on the federal level that would have prevented a shooting like the one we saw in Virginia Beach?
I do believe that if we had common sense gun reform across this country, there would be much less gun violence. And I think
But what about that one specifically?
It doesn't matter if there's a law that could have stopped that particular shooter.
Well, I mean, it might matter to the people who died.
No, you're missing my point. Every gun death is one too many. And so we should do these three things that I've mentioned specifically. Because I don't know enough about the shooter. I don't know why he decided to go on a rampage. I don't know if he had grave mental illness. I don't know enough details about him and why he decided to do this. I just know there's so much gun death in this country that we got to start with the three obvious things, which is banning the large magazines and the military-style weapons, which is stopping gun trafficking and having universal background checks. If we do those three things, we can protect a lot of lives. But this is just a shtick of the NRA. That question in of itself is complicit to the issues that we are facing. If you try to pick apart any one shooter and say, well, your solution wouldn't have stopped that, I don't know that it wouldn't have stopped that. If we didn't have the 15 mass shootings we've had in the last decade, maybe he wouldn't be inspired to become a mass shooter. We don't know. But what we do know is these are common sense reforms that if you don't have the guts to stand up to the NRA, if you don't have the guts to support publicly funded elections, I am the only presidential candidate that has actually put forward a way to get money out of politics, to stop the stranglehold of the NRA over these pathetic members of Congress who don't stand up to do the right thing. I'm the only person who has put forward something that actually begins to solve the problem and change who has the power. I want the power of our democracy to be in the hands of the people. I want voters to have as much rights as and as much voice as any Koch brother. And until you're willing to get money out of politics, you will never end gun crime in this country because you'll never have the ability to upend the power and the chokehold of the NRA, which is entirely motivated by the greed and corruption of the gun manufacturers, who care more about gun sales than people. Again, profits over people. I can't reiterate this enough. You got to get the money out of politics. You got to have publicly funded elections. You got to take on the special interests and the corruption in Washington. And frankly, I believe I'm the only candidate who has the courage to do that because that's what I've been doing for my entire 12 years in public service.
I want to ask you a question from one of our listeners. They wrote in, I am from the state of New York and moved to the great state of New Hampshire to enjoy the freedoms of the live free or die state. This person writes, why focus on gun control as common sense when you know full well that only law-abiding citizens will comply with any new restriction you impose? The very definition of a criminal is someone who does not obey the law. That is common sense. That's a comment from our listener. Your response.
Right. So let me tell you why my three reforms go after the criminal. Every single one of them does. So universal background checks. If you mandate that in all 50 states, you're going to catch people who shouldn't be able to buy weapons, people who have criminal convictions for violent crimes, people with grave mental illness, who have violent backgrounds, people who have restraining orders against them because they've abused their spouses. And three, making sure you ban the military-style weapons and the large magazines because it's so easy to buy those weapons. So those three things help us keep criminals from getting weapons. And for you not to understand that means you're not looking at the actual solution. Gun trafficking. Do you want to know who that stops buying a weapon? Criminals. Because right now, the states that have problems with gun trafficking, like New York and Chicago, those guns are literally taken from 1% of bad gun dealers, trafficked up in our state, the iron pipeline of I-95, and sold directly to gang members out of the back of a truck. You want that reform so gang members can't keep buying weapons without any possibility of a background check. So all of these ideas go after the criminal who shouldn't have the weapons, or the person who's gravely mentally ill, or the person on the terror watch list. And you've been misled by the NRA's talking points and beholden members of Congress who don't look at the facts and don't actually analyze the solutions and what's being offered. So you're being misled.
Listeners, this is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about policy ideas at stake in this 2020 campaign. Give us a call if you've got questions. 1-800-892-6477. We've got Senator Kirsten Gillibrand on the program. You can also send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We look forward to hearing from you, and we will be right back.
Recently on The Exchange, we explored a particularly New Hampshire institution.
A town minus its general store has a huge hole in it, and people know that. Even if you don't stop at the general store, you want there to be one because you know that that's like having the lights on. It's the pilot light of your town, and if it's out, you feel like there's something wrong.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. every weekday at 9 a.m. only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Today, a conversation with presidential candidate and New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Your questions are welcome as we talk about immigration and foreign policy and whatever else is on your mind. The number, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. Senator Gillibrand, I want to talk about something. It's been covered extensively, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I do want to ask you about it. You've said you were ashamed of some policy positions you've taken as a House member on the issue of undocumented immigrants, naming English as an official language, blocking certain benefits for undocumented immigrants. Like the issue with guns, you've changed your position and become more supportive of undocumented immigrants as a senator. So kind of the same question. Was there an experience you had or a series of facts you learned that helped you change your mind about how the U.S. government should treat undocumented immigrants?
Of course. Obviously, 10 years ago, when I started talking to folks in my state, I realized that I really needed to lead on this issue. I hadn't focused on it, and I hadn't led. And for both issues, I mean, the real question we have to ask is, would you rather have a president like President Trump, who has never changed his mind, never listened to constituents, learned, and then led on the issue in a different way? He's never had even an ounce of humility or regret about anything. And as a consequence, he's set in stone, and he makes bad decisions because of it.
And forgive me for interrupting. Listeners can grasp that you have the capacity to change your mind.
Yeah.
But I am curious about what specifically changed your mind with respect to immigration policy.
Just recognizing that the rest of my state and the rest of the country needed leadership on this issue, that while it might not have impacted my upstate New York, rural district with not a lot of diversity, but my state has so much and the country has so much. So I believe in comprehensive immigration reform with a pathway to citizenship. I believe in having a robust immigration policy that obviously you can have border security and make sure we have priorities to fund anti-terrorism, anti-cross-border, human trafficking, gun trafficking, and drug trafficking, which I would fully fund and keep under Homeland Security. But I think what President Trump's doing at the border is an outrage, separating families from their children. Seven children have died in custody because of President Trump's policies. The fact that there's 50 kids that they still haven't been able to reunite with their families and maybe not even having the ability to do so is a moral crisis and a humanitarian disaster. So I would take all of that work. I would put it back under the Department of Justice where it used to be. I would fund lawyers to have a real asylum system in this country again. I would make sure those families who are seeking asylum could have community-based solutions and not be locked up in for-profit prisons.
Would you allow those seeking asylum to come into the United States and not stop them in Mexico as the current administration has done?
Correct. I would have them go to border security, to go to ports of entry, state their asylum claims, and then begin a process that's a community-based process where they'd be assigned lawyers. I would also make sure we had real immigration judges, which we don't have right now. Our immigration judges are just hired by the attorney general and are, you know, may well be biased. We need ones that are appointed for life and make sure that they can actually deal with these asylum claims in a humane and legal process that reflects our values as a country.
At some point in your political career, you did support hundreds of miles of border fence. Mm. Is that, to some extent, still a wise thing to support?
You know, I believe that the local community and our law enforcement should decide whether different types of border security is effective or not. And if it's not, we don't need it. So I don't think being for a wall is wise. I think a wall is seen as medieval and is seen as something that creates, this impression of hatred and racism. So border security is very different than a wall, and I don't support President Trump's wall. I do support border security. I want to fund the anti-human trafficking, anti-gun trafficking, anti-drug trafficking, and anti-cross-border terrorism. That you can fully fund. You can fully fund the law enforcement, and I will always support that. But in terms of how we deal with immigration, it should be much more comprehensively, and it should be a much more humane process.
I want to get to a few other topics before we close out the hour. We had this question from Knut from Carroll who says, this is kind of a long comment, but I'll read it for you. One of the great things about New Hampshire is that right here in this little state, a candidate can really connect to a whole variety of voters. Carroll County is an example of a county in New Hampshire that has a lot in common with the states in the Midwest and that sometimes feel forgotten by the powerful ones. In 2016, Hillary Clinton did not pay attention to or seem to have forgotten about at least three key states that would have won the election for the Democrats: Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Now lots of Democratic candidates are coming to New Hampshire and spending a ton of time in the typical Democratic strongholds and spending quite a bit of time in the forgotten places. Wouldn't visits like to places like Carroll County help candidates like you, who are oftentimes seen as out of touch with middle America? So that's the comment from a listener.
Well, my view is I will go everywhere. My first trip to New Hampshire, I went to the North Country, and I met with Democrats at a senior center, and it was amazing. You'd figure 10 or 15 people would show, 100 people showed up. So I love the fact that New Hampshire takes its first in the nation primary so seriously, and people do show up no matter what county you're in, no matter how rural it is, and no matter how few people live there. I will go to all the places in this country, the red places, the purple places, and the blue places. I will be going. My first national debate was in Michigan. I will be going to Wisconsin this summer, as well as Ohio and Pennsylvania. I will be traveling to the red and purple places that I know I can win. They're very much like upstate New York. And we didn't talk about this at the beginning, but my first House race was in a 2-to-1 Republican district. It hadn't been Democrat for over 40 years. The last time a Democrat held that seat was right after the Nixon administration when they cleared House. And so I know, because I've done it, I won that 2-to-1 Republican district twice, the second time with a 24-point margin. I've not lost those counties since, and I've won them at a higher vote percentage. I also have the highest vote percentage in New York State at 72%. It's higher than any person who's ever run, Hillary, President Obama, any person for Senate or governor ever. And I just won back 18 counties that went for Trump in my 2018 election. So I don't just win electorally in red, purple, and blue places. I also get a lot done. I pass legislation. I pass big bills like the 9/11 health bill and Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, and small bills. I just passed 18 bills in the last Congress, all of which President Trump signed. I don't think he even knows he signed my bills, but he did. And that was stuff that could help New Hampshire, like money for rural broadband, money for small businesses who want to sell their businesses to their employees, money for rural-based manufacturing, all things that would help the economy in New Hampshire thrive.
You've been said to consider Hillary Clinton as a mentor of yours. So I wanted to ask, what lessons did you learn from her in general, and from her loss in 2016 in particular?
Well, I love the fact that Hillary Clinton has spent her career helping women and families and has been a role model for me and women across the globe. She did get that 65 million cracks in the highest and hardest glass ceiling, and she actually won the popular vote. So I think she's a great role model for all of us. And I do believe all the women running are standing on the shoulders of many women who've come before us for generations. And I get a lot of inspiration from all of them.
I want to ask you about foreign policy with the time we have remaining. So this week, oil tankers came under attack in the Gulf of Oman, the second such attack in about a month. And this week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that intelligence showed Iran was responsible for these attacks and that they were only the latest in a series of recent violent attacks by Iran. So as president, if you were in the Oval Office now, how would you be handling this situation?
So we do need to stand up to Iran and actually create accountability for their investment in terrorism. It's very important that we keep our country safe and secure and stand up to world leaders and other countries when they invest in terrorism and harm this country and our allies.
So there are some sanctions in place now.
Correct.
Are they not going far enough in your view?
We need to. It's a complex question, so I want to take it piece by piece.
Sure.
I would absolutely and always have supported crippling sanctions on Iran. It's why we got Iran to the negotiating table to pass the Iran deal. That deal was supported by the world community. It was such an important step forward in making sure that Iran never acquired nuclear weapons, which is why I supported it. I also supported it because our intelligence experts, our military experts all said, when Iran breaches, Even if we had to bomb their current nuclear facilities, we would only set them back a year or two. It wouldn't be sufficient. So being in the Iran deal, number one, they had to dismantle their centrifuges. They had to actually pour concrete into their heavy water nuclear production facility. They upended their whole nuclear production infrastructure. We knew where the mines were, the mills were, and the had access to all three bases, production bases, as well as the nuclear scientists. When President Trump removed himself from the Iran deal, he created enormous instability in the Middle East. He upended this Middle East process that we had in place to denuclearize the region and create a pathway to peace. He has created so much trouble for us with his saber rattling, with his constant aggressiveness, fighting for fight's sake, not to actually accomplish something. He is terrible on the world stage. He does not work with our allies. He upends institutions and agreements that have been in place for decades. And stepping away from the Iran deal was one of his biggest mistakes. So as president, I will stand up to Iran when they invest in terrorism. I will use the benefit of the world community to stop funding terrorism and to hold them accountable. I would re-engage them to try to have an Iran deal that lasted for 20 years, one that has a longer horizon so that we actually have a pathway to peace in the Middle East. And President Trump, all he's doing is saber rattling and making us less safe, not working with the world community, not standing up to world leaders like Putin or Iran in a productive way with our allies.
So with respect to Russia, nuclear power infiltrated our election system. What can you do about Russia?
Well, first of all, we should be standing up to Putin. And President Trump cozies up to him.
What does that mean? What does that mean, stand up to him?
It means a lot of things. It means standing up to him when Putin talks about not having interfered with our election and actually standing up to him in Helsinki and saying, excuse me, that is not true. We have evidence. We have indictments of Russian operatives who purposefully tried to undermine our democracy. I would make sure that we use the world community with sanctions against Russia. I would be holding Russia more accountable with regard to Syria. Russia continues to give Assad a pass and will not stop the humanitarian crisis happening in that country. We don't stand up to Saudi Arabia with the humanitarian crisis we have going on in Yemen with the Khashoggi murders. President Trump is a lackey for leaders around the country that seek to do our country and our values harm. And it starts by standing up to Russia and working with the world community in a multilateral way to hold them accountable for all the things they are doing, not only to undermine our democracy, but not standing up for peace in the world.
Well, Senator Gillibrand, we have to leave it there, but I appreciate you spending so much time with us today and spelling out your policy positions. Really appreciate
it. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Democratic President for Candidate and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, one of 24 Democrats running for president ahead of New Hampshire's first in the nation primary. And you can find all our coverage of the New Hampshire primary at our website, nhpr.org. Remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.